except for fuel publicity. How can we talk to what I consider to be the shameful just giving up of their responsibility of Congress? How can we talk to Kennedy? How can we talk to Kerry, my representative in the Senate Lynch? How can we talk to people like that in a way that really makes sense to them so that they won't cave in like they've done so shamefully?
Well, first of all, I don't agree that it doesn't make any difference. I think it makes a huge difference. So, for example, if you just look over the history of recent years, you can see the difference. The first time I lobbied Congress, actually first and last time, was with Howard Zinn. We went down in April 1965 to talk to our congressional representatives and senators. This was right after Lyndon Johnson had expanded the war in South Vietnam to the bombing of the North. I won't run through the details, but we couldn't even talk to them. Tip O'Neill wouldn't let us into his office. Saltonstall, who was the senior senator, said, well, you know, kind of let us give him our rap, and said, interesting, but the president has spoken. What are you talking about? Kennedy, who was then a junior senator, said, you know, it sounds kind of interesting, but I'm not... much my brother takes care of foreign policy issues. Of the people in Congress, the only ones we could even talk to were a couple of Republican representatives, who were in fact kind of helpful. But that's just changed over the years. And by now there's much more access and much more pressure because the population's changed. They are under popular pressure. And to the extent that they're under popular pressure, they will do things. They're not going to stand up alone. Very few do. I mean, you can count them on the fingers of one hand. There's an Ernst Gruning, and, you know, occasionally you'll find someone else. But these are people who are happy to say, I'm your leader, when there's enough people around for them to be the leader of. It has to be not just large in numbers, but active and committed. These things aren't achieved in a minute, you know. The anti-war movement in Vietnam took years before it got off the ground. The situation today is far more advanced than it was then. You didn't have hundreds of thousands of people on the street before Kennedy started bombing South Vietnam in 1962. It's different. And it's not just that. It's everything else, too. Civil rights, women's rights, environmental issues, all sorts of things that countries just changed. And it's changed because, we all have to understand these things don't happen fast. These are long struggles. I mean, abolitionism took forever. You know, it didn't happen by one demonstration. So you have to create the groundwork for it. And in fact, in the United States, it's my feeling is it's an easy, terrific situation for organizing people. The only way people are kept in line by now is by terrifying them with phantoms. And they are phantoms, you know, and it's not hard for people to get to understand that. But it's not going to happen easily. You know, it's going to take work because people really are afraid. And you can overcome that fear, but only by hard work. Pardon? Same. No. I mean, the media have their own agenda, which is to support power. If the general population changes and the culture changes and people's commitments and beliefs change, the media will partially reflect it. Otherwise not. For example, when the first, go back to 1965 again. 1965 happened to be the first public demonstration against the international demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And there was a big demonstration here on the Boston Common. It didn't take place. It was broken up by counter-demonstrators violently. I was supposed to be one of the speakers. I mean, the only way I got out alive was because there were a couple hundred state troopers around. The Boston Globe covered it, supporting the counter-demonstrators and denouncing the people who were daring to stand up and say, maybe we shouldn't bomb North Vietnam. Well, that changed over a couple of years. And it didn't change because their genes changed. it changed because the country changed. And that's where you have to work. You know, if there were a magic key to answer, to open these doors, somebody would have told us about it a long time ago. And there isn't. The only way to deal with it is by patient, constant educational and organizing activities. And we have to face reality. It is a very frightened country. It's not new, and it's not just Saddam Hussein. Takes a crime. Crime in the United States is approximately like other industrial countries. Fear of crime, on the other hand, is way beyond other industrial countries. The same is true of drugs. In other countries like ours, industrial countries, drugs are considered sort of a problem. You know, you deal with them. Here, it's turned into a threat to our survival. You know, if Canada is going to make the perfectly rational move of not arresting people and throwing them in jail forever for having a small amount of pot, people here will go crazy, you know. If they may cut off relations with Canada. Okay, those are things that, you know, those are the results of long and effective propaganda programs. They go way back. And it does go way back. I mean, some of you will be old enough to remember, I'm sure, that back in the early 60s, well, my own in Lexington, where I live, back in the early 60s when my kids were in school, they were literally being taught to hide under desks in the Lexington schools to protect them from atom bombs. You know, well, you know, we can laugh, but they didn't laugh. You know, and there's no place in the world where anybody was, where there was anything like this. I mean, for a long time, it's been an extremely frightened country, and that is exploited by unscrupulous leaders, and they're going to try to exploit it for the next election, just as Rove has said. And the only way to deal with this is to get to people and, you know, help them, participate with them so that they can get a sane grasp of reality. And it can certainly be done. I mean, it's been done on all sorts of issues. We don't have to go back very far to see how it's done. I mean, I mentioned a couple of cases. Let me take another one. I mean, there is an original sin in this country, very straightforward original sin, namely, why are we here? You know, what happened to the people who were living here? Well, you know, what happened, you know, is that they were exterminated, millions of them, like it wasn't small. Well, until the 1960s, that was simply not an issue. It wasn't an issue in scholarship, it wasn't an issue in consciousness. When I was a kid, we played cowboys and Indians, and we were the cowboys, and we were killing the Indians. I can't say it's, you know, there's been a, that it's so marvelous today. It isn't. But there's an enormous change in that respect, because people's awareness and consciousness has changed on issue after issue. And it doesn't happen by a gift. It happens by hard, dedicated, constant work, and it takes time. I mean, take something like women's rights. You know, it took centuries before it became right on the agenda.
Just a couple of questions. Why do you think Palestinians accept the current program? The Patriot Act or any other legislation, has that prevented us from getting Freedom of Information Acts over the last couple of years of the events that have gone on? And are you picking on C-SPAN on some of it? C-SPAN too?
Sorry.
Yeah. Sunday. Assuming my voice holds on. Patriot Act is a pretty rotten act. It has a lot of horrible things in it. But so far, it has been used mostly against very vulnerable people, where they're pretty sure they can get away with it, you know, like illegal immigrants and so on. They certainly want to use it against everybody. I mean, there's a real fascist streak in the administration. There's no doubt about it. And they would like to be able to really undo the whole civil libertarian tradition. But it's not so simple, because people are not going to accept it easily. With regard to the Freedom of Information Act, there haven't been many changes. I mean, the Bush administration, like the Reagan administration, wants the government to be free from scrutiny by citizens. They are not conservatives. They're reactionary statists. They don't think that the population has any right to know what the government's doing. So the Reagan administration very radically undermined efforts to get declassified documents from 30 years earlier. And the Bush administration is trying to do the same thing. But so far they haven't succeeded very much. And whether they succeed or not is up to us. You know, I mean, they can't really do these things if the citizens won't allow it. They're pushing it as hard as they can go. And they're pushing very hard. So just a couple of days ago, I don't know if this even made the papers, but there is a legislation which has been upheld by the courts for the last 20 years, the Alien Torts Claims Act, which actually goes back to the 18th century, which allows people to bring suits against foreigners or their local affiliates for acts like torture and so on and so forth. So you can bring a suit in an American court against a Indonesian torturer and so on, and against corporations. Well, one of the suits that's going on is an important one. It's worked up through the courts in California, is a suit against Unocal, big oil company, for using what amount to slave laborers in Burma. And it's being filed under this act, and it's moving along. The Ashcroft Justice Department just intervened with an amicus brief to support Unocal and to call for termination of any use of this act for torture victims and slave labor victims and so on. I mean, they really want to cut out civil liberties at every point you can look at. The new Patriot 2 Act, which they're thinking of, they're trying to sneak it through. It's leaked. You know, it hasn't been made public. It's leaked on the Internet. And law professors have written about it. So, I mean, they are actually intending to claiming the right to take away citizenship simply on what they call inference. So if the Attorney General infers, you know, from some pattern of action of yours that you're a terrorist supporter or whatever that means, they want to be able to take away your citizenship. I mean, that's unheard of in any Western society. But they will go as far as they can, and they have to be stopped, or else it'll be in bad trouble. As for why the Palestinians accepted the roadmap, first of all, it's the Palestinian Authority that accepted the roadmap. What the Palestinians may have in mind is another matter. But I can understand why they would have done it. I mean, they don't have a lot of alternatives. They are hoping they're under an illusion, I think, but they're hoping that somehow the U.S. is going to change its traditional position on this. There's no evidence for it, but they're hoping for it. And there's only one way to realize that hope, and that is for us here to force that change to take place. They can't do anything about it.
I think we have time for about two more questions.
Given that,
for
it. Iran and destabilization of that government. What do you see as that? How does that fit into the national security strategy of the military force being up there now?
Yeah, well, there has been some interesting stuff coming out about the actual planning for the war. I mean, it's been pretty obvious that they had made their minds up quite early, and most of everything that was going on was for show. But for those of you who want to look at it a little more closely, there's quite a good series that came out in the what I think is the best newspaper in the world, the London Financial Times business newspaper, best international business newspaper, had a detailed investigation of the planning, you know, as far as they could unearth from talking to people on the National Security Council and so on. And what they ended up with, and it's plausible, is that by mid-December, the Bush administration had decided there was definitely going to be a war. And their reasoning is interesting. It tells you a lot. The reasoning is and it's plausible. The reasoning was described by a high official who was involved in the National Security Council planning. He said by early December, the administration had the feeling that, I'm virtually quoting it, that a tin pot dictator is mocking us. And we don't let tin pot dictators mock us. That's called establishing credibility in international affairs or in the mafia, which are very similar. A mafia don does not allow some local tin pot to mock him. And if you have the biggest military force in the world and you know you're immune from retaliation, you don't let them mock you either. So we'll go destroy the country or whatever we feel like doing. It fits very well with the mentality, and it bears on Iran. I mean, the problem with Iran is it fails the first condition of those three conditions. Actually, it fails two of the conditions. It's an ugly place in many ways, but you can't claim that it has a horrendous record like, say, plenty of other states in the world. But the worst thing is it's not defenseless. And since it's not defenseless, it can't be attacked. So what the U.S. has been trying to do for some time, it's not just starting now, is to try to carry out subversive activities internal to Iran, which all fragment it or maybe cause uprisings or something. So there's pretty good reason to believe that at least for the last year and maybe farther back, the U.S. has been trying to stir up Azeri nationalist movements in the north, which do want independence and have some justification. In fact, the U.S. is now trying to do what appears what the Russians did in 1946, which is one of the early Cold War confrontations, where they tried to support Azerbaijani independence within Iran, which would have split up Iran. And the U.S. practically went to war over that at the time. But now it looks as though the U.S. is trying to do the same thing. And there are very complicated dealings going on in that region with the, you know, Azeri, Turkish, Israeli alliance, you know, trying to take power and control. There's pretty good evidence that a good part of the Israeli Air Force, which is not a small air force, it's bigger than and more technologically advanced than any NATO air force, except the U.S., a lot of it's stationed in eastern Turkey, and they're apparently flying reconnaissance over Iran as part of a preparation for some kind of action. It's probably not a direct attack because Iran can fight back. In fact, the U.S. is now driving Iran towards developing weapons of mass destruction, almost transparently. And intelligence agencies have pointed this out. Strategic analysts have pointed it out. I mean, the U.S. is making it clear to the world and has been for some time that if you're defenseless, we're going to attack you. So you better have a deterrent. And there's only two kinds of deterrent. One is terror, and the other is weapons of mass destruction. So the Bush administration is quite openly consciously causing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and increasing terror. I mean, every intelligence agency and their own analysts pointed out to them that the invasion of Iraq, that Iraq had, whatever you think about Saddam Hussein, he had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda and those guys, they're his worst enemies. But attacking Iraq would increase the threat of terror. And apparently that's what's happening. reports from around the world are that with the buildup of the invasion and the invasion itself, recruiting for al-Qaeda-style organizations is going up fast. And we just saw two major terrorist attacks, which may well be the effect of it. But they're perfectly willing to face that. I mean, they don't want terror, but they don't really mind that much. You know, if there are terrorist attacks or weapons of mass destruction, you know, not nice, but it's of low priority as compared with higher ones, like ramming through the domestic agenda and controlling the world. And furthermore, they know perfectly well that they can exploit terrorist attacks. I mean, there could be a serious terrorist attack in the United States. If you really want to be frightened correctly, take a look at the Hart Redman report on terrorist threats in the United States, high-level planning analysis that just came out. Good people. I mean, what they say makes sense. I mean, there's horrendous possibilities. I mean, it's like a cookbook. You know, we could do many of those things without very much talent. You know? And it's going to happen. And it will. You can increase the likelihood of it by refusing to ask where it's coming from. You know? If you react to it by violence, you increase it. I mean, every terrorist specialist knows this. If you look at the grievances and try to deal with them and so on, well, you can reduce the threat. They're doing the opposite. And the same is true with Iran. I mean, they probably are forcing Iran to accelerate efforts, if they have them, to develop weapons of mass destruction for perfectly sensible reasons. How are they going to defend themselves from a U.S. attack? And maybe to get involved with terrorist organizations, though there's no evidence that they are. The U.S. claims that they're involved with terrorist organizations, but you have to look at the definition of terrorist. So high on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations, very high, is Hezbollah. Okay, why is that a terrorist organization? Well, because it drove a U.S. client out of Lebanon. I mean, Israel invaded Lebanon 20 years ago, killed around 20,000 people, stayed on, ran a brutal military occupation in the south, and they were driven out by Hezbollah. Okay, that makes Hezbollah terrorists. Just like the current administration, the guy, you know, Powell, Rumsfeld, the rest, they regarded the Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress as, in their words, one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world, because they were resisting our ally, South Africa. So you've got to be really cautious about what's called terrorism. I'm not saying the Hezbollah are nice people, probably, you know, probably not. But their main, the main charge against them is that they drove a U.S. client out of an illegal military occupation. And it's undoubtedly true that Iran is supporting them. I mean, I mean, and look, the people running Washington now happen to be an unusually dangerous crowd within a spectrum that isn't that broad. That's what I was trying to suggest by quoting Dean Acheson and planners of the Franklin Roosevelt period and others. I mean, it's a narrow spectrum. And nevertheless, within that spectrum, there can be differences, and those differences can... These guys have so much power in their hands that small differences can translate into huge outcomes. So I think it makes good sense to prevent, I don't care about Bush, but the crowd around him from wielding power. On the other hand, any Democrat, I mean, Democrats have done the same things, you know. What has to be done is change the environment in which any of these guys are going to do something. And yeah, it's the just what you said is exactly correct. It's this 40 years of work have made a huge difference, not just in this area, in every area. I mean, anybody our age knows it. You know? So take my own university, MIT. I've been there for about 50 years. If you walk through the halls of MIT today, it's half women, about a third minorities, people casually dressed, which reflects personal relationships, means not much authority and subordination. If you walked through the same halls 40 years ago, it would have been white males, well-dressed, ties and jackets, obedient, you know. I mean, those are just changes that have taken place everywhere, and they're not insignificant. They've changed the country, and they change politics, and they change the media and everything else, and it doesn't come easily. The fear is very real, but, you know, that's the kind of element that, in a way, it's easy to combat. It's hard to combat security forces who are going to take you away and blow your brains out and throw you in jail and torture you. Okay, we're lucky. We don't combat that. What we combat is a culture of fear and subordination. Well, that's a lot easier to deal with. So, but it takes hard work.